Hey, this is Richard Deitch, and welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media about what they do and why they do it. This week's guest is ESPN's J.A. Adande. You know him from working as an NBA columnist as well as a sideline reporter on NBA games. Also has a new job as the director of the new sports journalism program at Northwestern's Medill School. And I asked J.A. about making that transition from working day-to-day at ESPN to joining academia.
This is something that's personal for me. So I think if you know me, people that knew me weren't that shocked and surprised.
We talk a lot about teaching journalism or sports journalism today at universities. Also, we get into J.A.'s career. He was columnist at the Los Angeles Times at 26 years old, covered Kobe Bryant, those great Laker teams. We'll talk about what is unique about covering sports in Los Angeles. Talk to him about ESPN and some of his experiences there, including working at the Undefeated, working on Around the Horn. And it was interesting to hear J.A.'s response to some of the criticism that Wilbon has received, particularly from Deadspin over the years. We also have some reader questions for J.A. It's a long podcast, about 90 minutes, but I think you're going to enjoy it. J.A. is a really bright guy, thoughtful guy, and I really appreciate him coming into the studio today. So J.A. Adande of Northwestern's Medill School, as well as ESPN, he's the guest on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast. All right, as promised, we bring in J.A. Adande, who has joined us on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. He is in town to see his beloved Northwestern team play at Yankee Stadium today. J.A., welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thank you, Richard. Great to be here. Happy to support my Wildcats, too.
Yeah, Jay, by the way, when you're heading up to the Bronx later, if you feel like stopping at the top journalism school in the country, Columbia is at West 116th and Broadway. So you may
is
wanna,
that where I can find the best journalism school?
Yeah, you may
want to. I thought it was in Evanston, Illinois.
No. You may want to just, you get out off the one and you walk up. You probably walk about 100 yards and then make a right, and that's the journalism school. There's a big, it's like Pulitzer sign there.
Do you have a lake, though?
We do not have a lake.
See?
No, we have ice. That's about it. All right, listen, Jay, let's start with this. In August, you were named the director of the new sports journalism program at Northwestern's Medill School. And my sense is that move probably surprised some people. You know, ESPN is a destination job. You're a sideline reporter as well as NBA columnist there. You're working for the Undefeated. You're on Around the Horn. So let's start off with that. That's a pretty dramatic career shift. Why did you make that decision mid-career?
It certainly wasn't something that came out of the blue. It had been in the works for a while. It's something that almost happened in 2013, actually. It was something I thought about. And it really what brought me back was the opportunity to go back and help out my alma mater. That's the main thing. And not everybody knows I've been teaching for 12 years. So a lot of people think this is new. I've been teaching at USC sports, start off as a sports PR class and moved into sports commentary.
Wow.
And I developed that, and it really was my favorite thing that I did. And I was looking to do something in an expanded role with that, and the chance to do so at my alma mater meant a lot more to me. And more people are surprised that I'd be willing to relocate to Chicago and
from
leave
Los
my
Angeles.
Beloved Los Angeles.
Right.
But I had 20 years in L.A., 20 prime years in addition to growing up there. I got to work there since 1997. So, and I still have my place. I've spent there. The last month I've been there for winter break, taking a break from winter. So it was time. It was an exciting opportunity. It was my school, and it felt personal. As much as I like USC, and I've been grateful there, and as convenient as the location is, 50 miles from my place, this is something that's personal for me. So I think if you know me, people that knew me weren't that shocked and surprised.
Northwestern obviously has a lot of prominent sports media alumni, Christine Brennan, Michael Wilbon. You know, we'll hit up some of these guys. I mean, you can't really, Mike Greenberg, you can't escape a Northwestern alum essentially at ESPN. But that's a lead in, J.A., to there were a lot of people probably that they could have chosen in terms of sort of high-profile alumni to come back to the school and to lead a sports journalism initiative. What was the process in terms of them? Did they reach out to you? Did you reach out to them? what was the process for you to get that job and ultimately take it?
It started with Dean Ham, Brad Ham, the dean who took over in 2012, and he gathered a bunch of us at homecoming. I had the honor of being the grand marshal for homecoming in 2012. Is our 20-year class reunion, and a lot of us were back there, and he wanted to meet with us. Mike Wilbon was in town. I think Brennan was there, and he had a list of all the Northwestern alumni working in sports media, and he said, okay, why aren't you guys more involved here? And those of you who are teaching, such as myself and Kevin Blackostone was teaching in Maryland
right,
and
yeah.
Why aren't you teaching here with us? You know, and he really wanted to tap into that network that you alluded to. And that kind of got it in my head. And also being back on campus, that was my first time back in a while, and being celebrated back on campus too. I just felt very welcome. And I thought, okay, I want to be here. I want to be a part of this. So that put it in my head. And he and I talked about it, and you know, I said, hey, maybe we could do something. And again, because I had the experience, I already had a foot in that world teaching at USC. I think that made it logical, and the fact that I was willing and flexible enough to do it. I'm not sure how many other people would have been willing to either set aside or carve out time mid-career to do it. But it's again, it just made sense, and it's personal, and you know, he kind of kept pushing me, and I kept calling him and saying, is this something we could do? And it took a while, and that's one thing I've learned in academia. Things take a while. And I think one of the reasons is the last time I can say I was young, something like I was young when I got my call from the LA Times. I was 26 years old.
Right.
You know, now I'm in my mid-40s. I'm not going to be young to be doing something anymore. Like you alluded to, you know, you're kind of young to be doing this mid-career. This is the last time I'll be young to do something, right? So that made it more exciting, too. It gave me more incentive.
What you know, none of these jobs, it's hard to sort of define what they are day to day, but what were you charged with by the dean to do at Medill?
Make us number one, the best sports journalism program in the world.
Okay, so how do you do that?
And that's his mantra. And what I've learned is you do it slowly and bit by bit. And I think he understands that, Brad Ham, because it took him 3 years just to get me. That was step one in his mind. But bit by bit, opportunities for students, and you just count your victories. That's what I've learned, is that the victories are going to be small, but you count them. A student is going to be at our Washington, D.C. campus next quarter, and she wanted to work at PTI and Around the Horn Studios for a couple days a week. And, you know, I kind of have some connections there, and I arm twisted a little bit, nudge. I'd say more nudge than arm twisted, but
right.
We were able to get it done. And, you know, I'm not sure that'll happen for everyone all the time, but this was something that we were able to make happen for this student. And she's really happy about it and very excited about this opportunity. So I count that as a victory. One of my first display projects was we had Doug Collins do a panel watching basketball through a coach's eyes. That was one of the first things I wanted to do when I got there, because,
cool.
You know, Doug with his son Chris coaching the basketball team
That's
in Northwestern is obviously around a lot.
Right?
And I've known Doug for a long time since he was – you know, right after he coached the Bulls when he was in Chicago, still doing media in Chicago, and I was covering the Bulls, I used to lean on him a lot. So I've learned so much about basketball from him, and I wanted the opportunity of the students to have that. And one of our students wrote a blog for our Medill sports site about her first quarter as a grad student in the sports program. And she said the highlight of her quarter was the Doug Collins panel. And I took that as a victory. So just smaller things like that, how can we enhance our students' opportunities, what exposure can we get for them? So we're taking a group down to the Super Bowl, not to cover the game, but to just cover everything that is in and around the Super Bowl.
Right.
And did a little wrangling with the NFL to get credentials. You know, I was like, can we get credentials for a few? And then they wound up credentialing the whole group for, you know,
for
press
Super Bowl
conferences.
Week. Right,
yeah,
right,
exactly.
Yeah.
Not the game, but for all the stuff that surrounds it. So I took that as a small victory. So just little things like that. And then hopefully you look back one day and say, wow, we've had a lot of these little victories. And most importantly, we've given a lot of opportunities to our students.
Did you teach any classes this fall?
I did not.
You did not? Okay.
By the time I was hired, it was too late to get on.
Will
the,
you,
on the
will you teach this spring?
So I'll start in the winter. So we're in a quarter system. So winter quarter is coming up.
What class?
My sports commentary class that I started at USC, it'll be a version of that. It's interesting adapting it to the quarter system, only 10 weeks. And doing it in the daytime now as opposed to nighttime. So we used to be able to, let's say, watch a Monday Night Football game and have them tweet about it or watch a baseball playoff game. So we're not going to be able to do any live events in class. But we'll see. We'll adapt, and I have to recruit a whole new group of class guest lecturers. You know, I have my network in LA in place.
Right.
So that's going to be a challenge. And then I want to hire a couple adjunct professors to, you know, we can't announce anything yet, but I want to do some things in analytics and TV production. Those are my goals, hopefully, for spring quarter.
How would you evaluate the quality of student who enters Medill?
Hi. I was always impressed going back to my first class at USC at how bright these kids were. And that made it a lot easier when I first started teaching. It was, okay, they're really smart. They know what's going on. But now it's interesting. As they get further out, attention span isn't the same as what it was. I've noticed that change just even in the 10, 12 years I've been doing it. And I just want to make sure that they pay attention to the details. And, you know, they're growing up with different standards than you and I grew up reading. And so teaching them that, okay, you know, loose language like this is not okay. It's funny to me. It's annoying sometimes when they'll send me an email and say, hey. And I say, you don't address people older than you as hey. You know, that's not a way to start off, especially if you're looking to get a job or something. It might work for me, and I get annoyed, but imagine the people that are going to be hiring you are older than me. And I doubt they're going to appreciate being addressed as hey.
Hey might be better than WTF, at least. One of the things that's going to be interesting, I think, this year for anybody who teaches journalism, and Jay McManus and I teach at Columbia together. She's one of your ESPN colleagues. And this is something we started to talk about a lot. We do fall-spring semester at Columbia. And that is how much this election will have on journalism heading forward. And it's not per se a Trump versus Clinton thing. It's more about the media has, for many people in this country, has dropped to a level in terms of confidence and trust that we've never seen before, Jay, at least in our lifetimes. Sports obviously is a different subsect from political writing, but these are students.
The same distrust is there.
Correct,
absolutely.
Right. These are students in their 20s who are about to enter a field where so many people really do not believe what you are writing to be factual. So particularly as you start teaching your winter class, and commentary is its own little interesting world, is that something you're thinking about just in terms of where the state of the media trust is now in relation to what you have to work on with your students? Because, well, maybe one of the most maybe exciting times to go into journalism because you want to be a force of change, probably no tougher time in the history of journalism to be a journalist, particularly if you go into anything political.
Absolutely. And I was smacked in the face with this. 2 days after the election, I was in Washington, D.C. We had an event. That turned into a very lively panel. We had some Northwestern alums who had covered the election, and they spoke at the National Press Club. And afterwards, I met with some of our students. We had dinner. Some of our students who were in D.C. for the quarter. And walking over, one of the students who's Asian American pulled me aside and said, you know, my friends and I, we're all people of color. We all want to get into journalism, and we're afraid. Just in the 48 hours, the first 48 hours after the election, just people had come up, you know, get out of the country. Some of the reports that you've
Muslim
heard about.
Yeah. Horrible.
And I thought, wow, that, you know, it's a double whammy, right? It's kind of trying, unsettling times for people of color and for journalists. The journalists were the targets of the Trump campaign, right? And they were portrayed as the enemy. And they talked about that in the panel, about how when they're in the pen at the Trump rallies, and just all the jeering and all the hatred that was directed to them while they're sitting there fenced off in the midst of the Trump rallies. So as a person of color and a journalist, it's a very frightful time. And I thought, wow, nothing I've done has prepared me for that question. And she said, what do we do? And I thought about it, and all I could think of was those pictures of the girls walking into the schools in Arkansas in the 1950s.
Right, Little Rock.
And the Norman Rockwell painting of that little girl with the tomatoes being thrown at her. And I said, go back and look at those pictures and go back and read those stories, and you're going to have to find that same courage within yourself to get through these times. And it's messed up because those women went through that, those girls went through that so that people wouldn't have to coming after, right? But yet here we are 50, 60 years later, and it's the same thing. But they did it, and they had that courage. And, you know, that's not an attribute we think of when you're getting into journalism or sports writing in particular, but it's going to take some courage, you know, to do your job when it's not the most popular thing. You know, it's not the 1970s, when Wilbon and Brennan went to Northwestern, it was right off the heels of All the President's Men. It was cool to be a journalist.
Exactly.
They just took down a president. And it's interesting. That same night, I walked by the old Washington Post building where I worked, 1150 15th Street Northwest. I'll never forget that address. And I'd been avoiding it because it's been taken down, torn down. It's a hole in the ground right now. And that was emotionally hard for me.
Yeah, symbolism.
But I said, I need to do it. And not just the symbolism of that building, but I felt like the profession. You know, like that world, that Washington Post doesn't exist. I don't think a newspaper or any journalism entity could take down a president right now because there's that lack of trust, like you said. You know, people wouldn't, you know, you could have all the goods, and in some cases they had the goods during this election, and the public didn't take that into account and didn't believe it and just chose to believe and chose to go in a different direction.
Yeah, I mean, in almost any other time in our history, what David Farenthold reported for the Washington Post would have ended the presidential candidacy of that candidate. Forget about the Access Hollywood and all that other stuff. But, like, literally, there would have been a time in this country where somebody would have read that.
Yep, that's
all
it.
Factual.
Disqualified.
And that's disqualified.
Like,
but it's a different world.
Howard Dean was disqualified for a one-second
Yeah, a crazy speech. CNN soundbite.
Right. And, yeah. and then that was it. Campaign over.
Exactly.
And those rules don't apply anymore.
One of the things that I think is really interesting about you being part of Medill is this idea of opinionists versus reporters. You have there's a lot of people in the business now who morph between these worlds of offering opinion. And we'll get to Around the Horn. All your Around the Horn buddies love me, Jay. you know, there's a lot of people now who morph between opinion to reporting, to commentary, and then do it on multiple mediums. You're somebody who's done this a lot and I think navigated it really, really well over the course of a decade plus. But when you're talking to young people today, how many of them want to be opinionists, like let's say Michael Wilbon, versus the beat reporter for the Dodgers? Or do they all see – or is it all in their mind now together and they're like, well – today I'm going to be a reporter, tomorrow I'm going to be the person who offers commentary?
I think they all want to sit in that seat on PTI or First Take or Around the Horn or
on, Jay,
you know, but that's that's what they want. And they want to skip those steps and without understanding that all of us were in the trenches before,
right.
You know, doing those beats, showing up at practices, going to locker rooms, all those things. You know, Stephen A. Smith did that. Michael Wilbon did that. Jemele Hill, sideline reporting and calm, like all the steps that people took. I spoke to a group of high school students that we had on campus a couple months ago, and I said, what do you guys want to do? And somebody said, I'm going to be like Stephen A. Smith. I said, okay, do you know how Stephen A. got where he is? Do you know the path he took? Blank look. I said, well, he covered Temple basketball, the Philly Inquirer. He covered the 76ers. He was a national NBA columnist for the Inquirer. He was a columnist for the Inquirer. He flew out to California, and he was doing Best Damn Sports Show. Like, this didn't just happen for Stephen A. And I'm not sure people understand, and maybe it's my job to explain to them, okay, these are the steps that it takes to get in that seat where you do get to spout your opinion. And you talk about me bouncing back and forth, and more so than ever now, I think it's delicate for me, and I have to watch what I say because now I am trying to partner. You know, so I'm dealing with the NFL and asking them for credentials for my students.
Right.
So if I'm blasting Goodell in the NFL constantly, you know, how is that going to go over? So I'm probably more careful than ever. But the last 3 years as a sideline reporter, too, has taught me to I don't just go in on coaches because I'm going to have to be standing them at the end of the first and third quarters talking to them. And, you know, what happens if they just saw me blasting them on a round horn today? What kind of answers are they going to give me? Is that going to serve our viewers better? You know, if they shut down because they're mad at me for something that I said.
I want to ask you about young people of color who want to go into the sports media. You know, it's very important for, I think, young people to have role models in front of them. You know, that's where Jemele Hill is a really important figure in the business as an African-American woman who is prominent on television, prominent offering opinion, essentially a pioneer in that sense. But there's only one of her, you know, at this point. You look around, and there are certainly national figures like yourself and Wilbon and Stephen A. Smith who have, you know, prominent roles, a lot of former athletes too. But the diversity in local media in sports is pretty horrible still. I imagine at Medill you have students of color. So when they – and this is just – it's something I've tried to write about a lot. You always get sort of blowback from people who like don't want to talk about race and politics. Although to me, race and gender and politics are all related to sports. I don't know how you can escape it. But what are young people of color, let's say at Medill, who want to be in the business? What kind of questions are they asking you? And then what do you tell them? Because they clearly can see someone like Wilbon or Stephen A. Smith, but that's not the job they're getting out of school. They might go to Anniston, Alabama and work for a local paper. And what happens if they're the only black kid on that staff? And how do they deal with that, especially, let's say, if everybody in the college football program they're covering, except for the athletes, are white? As someone who is a and I realize I'm sort of filibustering a long question, but you're someone who they literally can see on TV and like, this guy's done this, I want to be this guy. So what do you tell them when they sort of go up to you and say, I don't see a lot of people outside of these five people on TV. How can I become that person?
Well, it's funny. Sometimes you don't realize the importance of what you're doing.
Right.
And, you know, when word went out on the – we have a National Association of Black Journalists Sports Task Force email group that you know, we mention scholarships or job opportunities, or sometimes we just get discussions going. And so when my hiring was announced and they sent out word in the group, you know, someone said, hey, this is going to be really good for us, and having one of our members in this position will help. And just the sports specialization program in itself, they found brought out a very diverse group of applicants. So the group that's there right now, I walked in the room and saw them when I first got to campus. We had a meeting set up, and I was blown away by the diversity in the group. And they said it's because this interest in sports is bringing people that might not have applied to our grad program in the first place. So right away, the broad interest in sports, that's one of the things that we all are interested in, right? Regardless of race and gender. We love sports, and that's being reflected in the applicant pool. So that made me extremely happy. Before I even got on campus, that group of diverse, I watched African-American men and women, period. You know, it was probably half, if not more, female, Asian women. You know, it's just this great mixture in the sea of colorful faces and men and women. So that's already happening, and I'm excited even before I got there that's there. And then, okay, making people aware of the groups like NABJ or the Asian American Journalist Association or National Association of Hispanic Journalists, that there's people out there like you. There's groups, there's networks, there's support that you can find. You know, because, yeah, you are going to be the only person of color in the press box sometime. You are going to be the only woman in the locker room at times. But you're not the only one going through that. You might be the only one in your immediate area,
right,
but you're not the only one going through that. So there's people that have been there before, and there's people that were there long before you. So you mentioned Jemele Hill, and I tell our group that when I see Jemele Hill, I see Claire Smith,
right,
who just went into the Baseball Hall of Fame, who was the pioneer, and you know, Larry Whiteside. Before Michael Wilbon was in a press box, Larry Whiteside was in a press box. Sam Lacy, Ralph Wiley, Stuart Scott, and Brian Burwell. And I'm mentioning people that are no longer with us, John
right.
Saunders, because I was fortunate enough to have worked with them, to have known them, to have, you know, covered NBA finals with them. And that's part of what I want to do, too, is to carry on what they did and make sure their lessons weren't lost. And Brian Burwell was a guy who helped me get where I am just by what the advice he gave me at the time when there was five African-American sports columnists at newspapers in the country in the early 1990s.
Wow.
Him and Burwell, or Burwell and Wilbon, Kevin Blackstone.
He was in Dallas,
Terrence
Blackstone.
Moore. Blackstone was in Dallas. Terrence Moore was in Atlanta.
Yeah, right.
Roden was here in New York.
That's right.
They called him the Five Heartbeats. They had a panel at
the 1992. Is that right, the Five Heartbeats?
That's
never heard of that.
It was right after the movie came out, and they had a panel with them, and it was five. And one of the things that Burwell was adamant about is when you have a chance, and this kind of reflects to one of your earlier questions, when you have a chance to write commentary, because at the time, having your opinion was rare.
Right.
You know, beat writers, you stayed here in your lane and
right,
you
right.
report the news. And Burwell would always say, you know what, Sunday, let me write an opinion column. You know, let me give my opinion, because not a lot of people were doing it. Certainly not a lot of African-American sports
right.
writers were doing that. So Burwell pushed for that. So he helped me get to a point where I could write a column. Again, as a 26-year-old African-American male, I had a column in the LA Times. And that's because Burwell pushed me to take the steps toward that. And so I want people to remember what the Burwells and the Ralph Wileys were doing long before myself and Stephen A. and these guys were around.
Let's get into that. First of all, now that I think about this, what a joke that New York did not have any black columnists in like the 90s and 80s. New York City.
Well, you had Roden.
That's it. And one. Then, Daily News and
the
Post.
You know, but then Rob Parker came here and right. George Willis got one.
Right. Although Rob Parker did not really have, it wasn't sort of a prominent columnist in New York for the Daily News. George Willis, though, did.
Sean Powell,
yeah, Newsday, who's great.
So he started at Newsday, right?
But these are still pretty late, though. We're not talking 70s or 80s.
And it was always one.
Right.
You know, very rarely, even at the Washington Post, which George Solomon produced, you know, one of the most diverse staffs in history.
But this is, I mean, come on, New York City. I mean, it's ridiculous if you think about it in hindsight.
How many then or now, you know, how many African-American sports columnists?
Trying to think, Mariotti, Talendur, Lindsay Cohn.
I mean, Fred Mitchell was doing the notes column.
Right.
Michael Hawley was there briefly, went back to Boston
right. That's right, Chicago.
Chicago, you know, so it's great. And who
And again, newspapers are the place that preaches, you know, we want to reflect our constituency. We're supposed to be a diverse place. That's pretty
Who replaced me in L.A.? I was the first African-American sports columnist at the L.A.
I don't
Times.
Know. Who did replace you in L.A.? Nobody?
Not African-American.
Jesus.
And how many Latino sports columnists are there in that market, you know?
Yeah, well, that's a whole other discussion. That's a really under, I would think both Latino and Asian American sports writers are really underrepresented.
You got Tim Kawakami in the Bay Area.
That's it, though. In the markets where there's prominent demographics for Hispanic and Asian American readers. It's just dumb business, by the way, ultimately, in the end.
I mean, I used to go around at the LA Times and say, how many bylines do we have that end in easy? In this market, you know, how many do we have in our sports section or elsewhere? And it was embarrassingly low.
Yeah, and I just, again, in cities like L.A. and New York, I wouldn't expect that, but that's what happened. All right, so you're a 26-year-old columnist in Los Angeles. This is a question that Seth Wickersham of ESPN forwarded along. It's pretty interesting, and he wanted to know, who I'm sure you know.
Yes.
Did you feel comfortable at 26 writing opinion, or did you have to grow into the job of sort of having takes on major athletes in Los Angeles?
One, I was fortunate that I was in L.A. because I grew up there. I knew I had a frame of reference. I almost got a column in Philadelphia at the Daily News. John Smallwood wound up getting it, and they were talking to me. And in retrospect, I'm glad I didn't get it because it probably would have been a disaster.
It's a tough town. Yeah. Smallwood was in Rochester before he got that. I remember seeing him.
But he was already there in Philly, you know, and they promoted him to the column spot, and he did a great job with it. And I was disappointed. That's really the only thing I didn't get that I was in position to get, I think. And it was probably much better. I was much proud. Because I would come in 24, 25 years old, outsider. You know, I knew a little bit about the history, but I couldn't speak to them. You know, I couldn't tell them about the pain of being an Eagles fan or something, you know. And so they probably would have shredded me. But being in L.A., I knew that market. I knew the history there. So I think I could do it. But it was funny. When I got it, I was like, yeah, I got a sports column at the L.A. Times. And then when I started, I sat down. I get in the office. I said, oh, shit, I got a sports column in the L.A. Times.
Right, pressure.
Don't forget to get that.
The last three podcasts had the explicit tag, so this is four now. We're good.
You know, but it was really that moment of fear. And then I went out there and I did it. And I'll hate to plug my school like this, but, you know, I said, okay, do what they taught you at Medill. That's what I did. Same thing when I got my first internship at the LA Times coming off my sophomore year. And I was all excited. And I get there and I said, what do I do? And I said, okay, do what you know how to do. And I started my column and said, okay, what, you know, do what got you. And it's interesting. Sean Powell started Newsday at the same time. Now, he was older than me and been in the business longer, but he was new to column writing.
Right.
So we would call each other a lot and talk each other through it. I'd call Wilbon. You know, Wilbon basically wrote my first guest column when I was at the Chicago Sun-Times. You know, they let me do a Sunday column once, and I called Mike and I said, what should I do? And he walked me through it.
Wow.
You know, Ralph Wiley, Roden, those guys, you know, those resources that I had helped me walk through my early columns. So that's how I did. I just said, okay, they hired you for a reason. Rick Jaffe, the guy who's so instrumental in my career, hired me and believed in me. So make him look good, too. So it wasn't just me. Like, I had to make Rick look good for hiring me. So I didn't think about it, but there was also the notion that, okay, you know, this is for other black sports writers who want to get out there. This is your chance. You're representing them.
Yeah.
And it's an unfair burden. You know, just like Jemele Hill has an unfair burden.
Yeah.
But it's there, and so you have to do well because the door might not be open if you don't do well.
That's always interesting to me because, like, I mean, let's just be blunt. Now, first of all, now that we can curse, this is exciting to me. Now, Jay has opened
open the door. What have I done?
Jay,
what have I
rocked? Jay has opened that motherfucking door up, so now we can go. What's interesting is that when I write a sports media column or at Sports Illustrated, I don't feel like there's nobody behind me. It's like I don't have that burden. And that's always every person I've interviewed on this podcast as well as just talked to in the business. If you're a person of color, you always feel that. You always feel like you're working for those behind you. Now, I'd like to think like I'm working for like Columbia J-School students behind me, but it's different. And in the circle of people that you deal with, NABJ and everything else, everyone thinks that, right? Everyone always believes that what they do ultimately is going to reflect after them. But that is not the same. I mean, I don't want to speak for every white sports writer, but the truth is you don't really – I don't – it's not something I think about every day. But that's interesting to me that you do, right? You feel like I got to represent because the person who's 24 right now is looking at me and I have to set that path.
And it's not a constant – you know, it's something that you get reminded of.
Right.
I remember writing something about the NBA dress code one time, and I said, look – It's not about them. It's about the kids that are watching them and that are going in that don't have the talent to wear whatever they want, that are going into job interviews and have to dress the part. And if they see people showing up for work wearing whatever, baggy jeans, whatever, and they get the notion that they can go into work wearing that, no, you can't. If you're a young black kid trying to make it in Wall Street or wherever, that's not going to cut it. And so the NBA dress code was very controversial at the time, but I said, right, this is a good thing because it's setting a good example for a young black man. And I was at the airport a few days later and I saw a black man with his son and he looked at me and he just said, thank you.
Wow.
And it just kind of hit me. And I get the feeling he was referring to that column. But I'd like to think that it just made it easier for him to tell his son, okay, this is the steps you have to do in order to get jobs and be employed and have a nice career. And that's moments like that when it hits you, it's not constant. I don't show up every day. I don't write every column.
No, I understand.
Thinking that, but there's just moments where you're reminded. And then when you go to the NABJ convention and you see the young kids coming up and they want to be where you are, and they have all these questions and it's invigorating. Actually, it's not a burden. It's kind of invigorating that you can serve as an inspiration to them.
What is unique about covering sports in Los Angeles versus other markets? Given your ESPN work, you traveled around the country, but for a long time, you were really an LA-based writer. So what did you find that was unique about LA sports versus any of these other cities?
It was a market that appreciated great commentary, because think about it, and I grew up there, so we were raised on Jim Murray writing the LA Times in a high level. When I was growing up reading the LA Times sports section, Rick Riley was there, Richard Hoffer, Michael Litwin, Scott Oster, Mike Towne, all these great writers were there. So a high level of sports discourse and discussion. And then let's move on to the announcers, Chick Hearn, Vin Scully, Bob Miller, all these guys in the Hall of Fame. So for their respective sports. So that high standard was set.
Right.
Growing up, reading all those people, I've always thought it was a high level of discussion. The in and out daily passion of Detroit, Cleveland, where the city lives and dies with every game, that's not there so much. But the love is there. The knowledge is there, and the expectations of excellence. A lot of people have been chiding LA sports fans, like, oh, look at the TV ratings for the Rams and look at the attendance for the Rams. Well, you got to win. Like the Lakers sell out and will have continued to sell even these last few years because the standards that they set. When the Dodgers are good, they're pulling in 3 million. The Angels are going to draw 2.5 million. There have been times when SC and UCLA football are both rolling. There'll be 80,000 at the Rose Bowl and 90,000 at the Coliseum on the same day. So it's there. You just have to produce. And I think that's good. I think it's a discerning market that the fans are not just going to show up just because there's a game that they know. They're going to show up because you're putting a good product out there on the court or on the field.
I think there's a perception, especially on the East Coast, Philly, New York, Boston markets, that Los Angeles maybe is a softer media town than the East Coast. and Chicago. Is that is that a stereotype or is that true?
They're not going to kill the coach every game, and the tone is set. Jim Murray wasn't a fire the coach type guy,
right?
And so it's interesting to me because I can always hear and read and see the reflection of the dominant people in the market. Like when I see and listen to a Mike Breen and Ryan Rucco and these guys that came up from New York, you hear Marv Albert. And if you listen to Bill McDonald, who's doing the Laker play-by-play
Chick
now,
Hearn.
Yeah, you hear Chick Hearn.
Right.
And it's just, you can't help. I don't even think it's intentional, but that's you grew up hearing that style. And so growing up, you know, that was a tone that was set by Jim Murray and the other writers out there. You know, it's not Philadelphia. It's not New York. Those are tougher media markets. You know, there's fewer rooms for missteps. Everything is scrutinized. You know, just the culture that was set here in New York when the newspapers were dominant. You had the tabloids competing for back pages and trying to get George Steinbrenner to say something.
Of course.
You know, the Steinbrenner stakeouts that they used to have outside of Yankee Stadium.
Right.
You know, people look because they needed that. They needed that back page to grab people and to sell papers. You know, you didn't have that in L.A. Did I contribute to that as a writer at the L.A. Times for 10 years? Maybe. You know, maybe, you know. Did I go after Shaq every single missed free throw? No, but you know there's a bigger picture out there.
Speaking of those teams, how would you say Kobe? You and Kobe Bryant have a long history of sort of reporter interview subject. Isn't there a famous one to say "Not today, J.A."? Great video, like somebody mentioned.
It's not a video. So Tony Kornheiser has totally butchered that quote over the years. So the original interaction, I said, hey, Kobe, you got a minute? We're in the parking lot after a Laker practice. I said, you got a minute? He says, no, I don't have a minute, J.A. And okay, then. And so Kornheiser loved that. Somehow that got back to Kornheiser and Wilbon. And so Kornheiser made it into, got no time for you today, my man. That's the Tony version, which is not the original quote. And so they'll say, it's funny, one time they were going to break, and Wilbon just, like, tossed my name out there. Mm-hmm. They were talking about the NFL going to L.A., and Wilbon said, hey, Donde will have something to do. And then Tony on the way out just says, no time for you today, J.A. So there was that. I mean, Kobe, I basically covered his whole career. I got back out to L.A. in 97, his second year, and we had our ups and downs along the way. We went a year or two without speaking to each other.
No kidding. Probably, was it something you wrote or some other?
Yeah, some I wrote, some I said. And actually, you know, we talk about being tough and where the line is. And I made the mistake of making it personal, you know. And you asked me earlier about criticizing and how do you draw the line. I think it's fair and I think people can relate to if you criticize them, their decisions. I think we all make a mistake, and it's very easy to do in the social media area when you get into the person.
Of course.
And one thing I don't appreciate is when people presume to know motives behind what I say and write. You know, you can judge me by what I say. Don't act like you know the reason why. Oh, ESPN told you this. No, that's not the case at all.
Right.
And so I got personal with Kobe one time. I went to apologize. He cursed me out. We went a few more months without talking, but we've had times where things were good, where he's like, here's my number, call me, let's shoot the shit since we're in curse mode. You know, so he called.
Is he the most compelling figure that you covered during your
tenure?
You know
what I told him? So it was interesting. When the day he formally announced he was going to retire at the end of last season and we walked out together, and there's been so many times he and I walked down that corridor at Staples. I was just there Christmas Day and I was walking that corridor. I said, man, Kobe and I have a lot of interesting conversations walking down that hallway, that corridor. And so we did it again that time. And he just kind of came over. He was just in a good mood, you know. And so we kind of hugged. And it's like, he said, man, you know, we go way back, don't we? I said, yeah, back to the days when you had the afro. And I stopped and I told him, I said, you know what, though, Cole? You always made it interesting. And as a newspaper columnist, all we can ask for is interesting and compelling stories. And good and bad, you know, controversial. He was always fascinating. You know, he might go for 60 points. He might trash the organization. You know, you never know what he was going to do. But he was so compelling. And that's all we can ask for. And, you know, he's certainly among the most fascinating people. And it's regretful because he didn't allow you in the way Michael Jordan and Magic Johnson let the people that were covering them inside. He always maintained that barrier. He was much more distant than so many other superstars. And so I had a courtside seat. Figuratively, not exactly courtside, but, you know, I was 5-10 rows from the court most of the time in his career. So I was a witness to it, but I don't feel like I was inside, really inside. I saw him I probably saw Kobe Bryant over the last 20 years in person, face-to-face, games and practice, more than anyone else in my life, which is scary. I told him about that one night. He's like, man, that's fucked up. Right. But it's true. You know, John Black, the Laker PR director, is, you know, I've seen him more days probably. But you know, Kobe and some of the guys in the Lakers, I've been a part of my life more than anyone else in my life. So
do you think anybody got him? Do you think there's any media person who got inside? Or did he really
at
have
times,
the wall?
You know, like you know, Jim Gray, you know, like that year, he was talking to Jim Gray. It was weird. There was one year where I was kind of his guy. You know, Kobe was very savvy, and he knew and it seems this is something that's changing too, where you don't need a local guy anymore.
Right.
So much in this national media era.
Not if you're Kobe or LeBron.
At that time, and Kobe still came up in a newspaper era, where you needed somebody in L.A. And there was a year or two where I was his guy. Plashy might have been his guy. T.J. Simers was his guy for a couple of years during the Shaq Wars.
Right.
You know, so I think there was a year or two. And then, you know, he had other people, other outlets he could go to at other times.
I want to ask you about the television work on the sidelines.
Around the horn?
Yeah. No, we'll get to around the horn. Trust me. I'm saving that for dessert. You are represented by CAA, Evan Dick.
Yes.
I know a lot of these guys. Big, powerful agency. And I'm always interested in, first of all, I know the CAA guys really don't like to be mentioned. So I love just mentioning them just for that alone. But it's a very interesting part of the business because you got to ESPN, you're doing columns there after being at the LA Times, but not everybody gets to do sideline. Not everybody sort of makes that next jump. And I wonder, and this is an interesting thing for your students as well, could you have made the jump to television sideline work without being represented by a big agency? Is it possible to get those kind of jobs without having that connection? Because that obviously is what the agency sells people like you on, is that we have relationships with ESPN producers and management. We can help you take the next step. That can be your next step for 10 years, not just 1 year.
What Evan and CA do is more make sure that the compensation is there and fair.
Right.
I feel like you get things on your own merit.
It's interesting.
You know, I don't think my agency has ever gotten me, or any of my agents have gotten me, you know, to a place.
Right.
But I feel like they've done a good job representing me and negotiating on my behalf. The first real main CAA payout I felt like I got was this summer when they got me in this Gatorade online ad series. It was with J.J. Watt and Karl Anthony Towns and Bryce Harper.
I don't think I saw that.
And it was good.
Great job for you, though, man. That sounds like a lot of money.
Well, it was fun. It was a nice chunk of cash. And then I realized later, I was like, oh, wait, all these guys are CAA guys. So, you know, it's a whole package.
I got you. So you were part of the larger package.
Yes,
interesting.
Yes.
But that's what they can do.
That was CAA.
Right.
And it was a nice chunk. And it was fun. And it actually helped professionally just spending some time with those guys, those athletes, away from the locker rooms. And I got to know Karl Anthony Towns and J.J. Watt and Bryce Harper a little bit. You know, just
any qualms about working for a brand, although you don't
sponsor.
Cover Gatorade. Yeah.
Yeah.
No issues. Okay.
You know, well, it's interesting. I think we all have to get over that. Like the Medill graduate in me, you know,
yeah,
to be representing
right.
a brand. It's
I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
The game has changed so much.
Correct. Right.
You know, I mean, we're partners, for example, on Christmas when I'm introducing the coaches interview. It's time now for the coaches interview brought to you by PlayStation 4.
Right.
You know, so
it's a larger discussion. It's just I used to be someone who was sort of – it was black and white for me. Journalists shouldn't do advertisements. And now I've sort of I've changed a little because the world has changed. I do think, though, that you can't – like if you were a sports business reporter, I would not take that Gatorade job. But as a – you know, if you're doing commentary like you do, I don't think there's a conflict unless you're starting to write about what your favorite drinks are, which you're not going to do.
Or it's interesting. I mean, we just talked about – we had this whole – I called it sneaker week. You know, we were talking about our favorite shoes. You know, I mean, should we be kind of promoting different brands, you know, sponsors? You know, it was a gray area. Or you might have said it wasn't gray. Like you said, maybe when you were at Columbia, it was black and white.
Yeah. They're pretty hardcore. They're still a little hardcore with that. I'm no judgments here. I'm just saying, like, a lot of it, I think, is when you were 23, who was yelling in your ear about this stuff, right?
And I feel it's changed. Yeah. 23-year-old me probably wouldn't have been allowed to working at the Washington Post or the LA Times.
Right.
And, you know, I probably would have had more qualms about it, but it's just it's different now. And I don't know if it's better or worse, or is better financially.
For sure, no. there's a ton of okay. So that's interesting though. So you got the job on merit. They take care of the compensation to make sure that you are paid the same as other sideline reporters, at least in terms of the amount of dates and stuff that you do.
And the peripheral stuff.
And the peripheral stuff.
Are you going to fly first class to the game? You know, right. Things like that. Are they going to have that in your contract? So just having the wherewithal to, okay, so how do we navigate now that I'm have multiple positions where I'm working for Northwestern, I'm working for ESPN. And so that's what Evan and CA handles. Yeah. You know, I don't want to worry about the money. Like, I'd be uncomfortable going in and say, well, I want this amount of money. Here's my worth. I want somebody else to establish
So you never, when you're negotiating contracts, you never deal with ESPN management. That's them. And they eventually come back to you and say, here is what they're offering right now. And then you discuss
it
with them.
Exactly. Gotcha. Okay. And some people, you know, might not be comfortable giving up a portion of their salary to do that.
Right.
It's funny, like the Gatorade money I made, I just forwarded it over to them. Like, okay, here's you know what I owe you for standard
industry stuff, like 10% or 3%. Okay, all right, yeah, depending on what the deal is. But you know what, if 10% is a lot more, you know, if they've gotten you a lot more money than you could have gotten, that 10% and that is worth it. And in the, you know, when they hooked you up with that CAA thing, that can't happen without them,
right?
So that's real money,
right?
That's interesting because the I'm always fascinated by the fact that a lot of talent, and we'll call you talent in this case, never steps into the negotiating booth with the there's a guy at ESPN who does a lot of these deals, Rob Savinelli. There's obviously John Skipper or Burke Magnus.
Al Jaffe back then,
Connor Shell. So, like, it's interesting. So many times the talent never talks to the people who are negotiating the deal. It's the agent who is doing it and then bringing that back.
And I think it's better that way.
It might be. There are some people at ESPN who John Buccigross is someone who doesn't have an agent who does the negotiating himself.
Bill Simmons didn't.
Simmons too. And you do. You know, the question would be: yes, you don't have to pay the agent, but did you get fair value? And the agents do know what everybody else is making,
right.
Which and ultimately information and knowledge is power. It's a really interesting part of the business that you know, kids at Columbia and Medill don't know anything about, but if they get to those levels, they're going to have to.
Well. There's enough to worry about doing my job,
right.
And
yeah, I understand
jobs
that.
Now, right. and so I just let them have that, and also, you know, that's the stuff that we can't teach you in journalism school, and I certainly can't teach. I don't know the art of negotiation, and so, you know, that relieves us from having to teach our students and soon to be graduates those type of things, and B, they should let somebody have it. You know, either hear it from somebody who knows more about that. We can tell them more. You know, I can tell them things I've experienced. Like, it's crucial to have base salary. Like, don't sleep on base salary because so much is based on that. You know, your 401k compensation
is
based on your base. You know, any future raises, you know, overtime pay, it's all going to be based on base salary. So when I'm talking to young kids getting in business, like, I'm always a stickler for base salary. So I can tell you those type of things from my experience, but I can't tell you how to extract more money from the powers that be.
By the way, let's give a shout out to Michael Klein of Max Entertainment, Max Sports Entertainment, for the Bomani Jones contract. Good job, good work by him. All right,
but that's Bomani's talent.
Absolutely, yeah. You know, and Bomani gives ESPN multiple hours, gives them radio hours, right, and then gives them television hours on Highly Questionable, and then can also do Around the Horn or OTL and other stuff.
But Bomani's the first one to say, "Hey, I pay my agents because I'm not good in that arena."
Right.
You know, they are. And
one of the things I respect about Bomani, the agent that he has works at an agency that has multiple clients, but that's not the biggest agency in town. He's a loyal guy who stayed with his guy who worked with him, I think, when he was in the Triangle and sort of moving up. I always like – and you've been with Evan Dick for a long time, right?
Yeah, Evan, with Nikon, and then CA, and then they came over and – it's a long story.
You're like Kobe, Jay. You're saying you're loyal. A couple more things here I want to get to before you have to head out to Northwestern's big game at Yankee Stadium. For a piece on the undefeated, for the undefeated, I should say, you wrote about cleaning up quotes, mm-hmm. which was pretty interesting. It's a really great subject to me. And you say that it's a tradition that needs to go. This is you open quote. For one, it's patronizing with the implication that anything that deviates from the norm is inherently inferior and must be corrected. Black English, for example, isn't a referendum on intelligence. It's a reflection of centuries of segregation, just as American English is a linguistic representation of our country split from Britain. When you wrote this column, man, this there was a lot of not soul searching is the right word, but debate about like sort of what is the proper thing to do. This was off a guy in Houston who I'm trying to remember this. Did not clean up. Remind me.
It was a baseball player who was talking about his struggles the year before, and it was. You know, Spanish trying to, you know, a Spanish speaker speaking in English and all the subject-verb disagreement that you might expect in that case. And the player felt like the writer had kind of set him up to make him look bad.
Look stupid, right?
By quoting him and was out to get him. And also, I was playing off the Leandro Barbosa, we gonna be championship.
Right. So you are of the belief that I'm with you. I think quotes should be verbatim. Because I think this is actually one of the things that my old professor at Columbia, Sandy Padway, believed too. One, it's truth and transparency to the reader. But two, you end up losing the flavor of what the language is if you – I don't even know what it is. If you Anglo-Saxon it, you know what I mean?
Right.
But there are a lot of people who disagree with us and think you should clean it up.
I didn't use probably the best example, and I later talked about it with Harvey Ayrton, but – probably the all-time greatest example of a time you had to quote directly or else it would be an entirely different meaning was
Michael
Richardson, the ship be sinking.
Right.
Now, if he said the ship is sinking, that quote gets lost for eternity. But the fact that he said the ship be sinking, that's an all-timer. And I asked Harvey later, it's funny, I messaged him. I said, how come you didn't clean it up? You know, was there any thought or debate to fixing that quote? And he said, oh, man, I was working at a tabloid. You know, like we weren't thinking about that. We had no morals or standards. But that quote, as is, you know, became a classic. The ship be sinking.
Right.
And but the thing is, he had the option then because it was just him, a couple writers, no cameras, no recorders around.
Could have changed.
And one of the points I wanted to make in that story was that today when so many of these interviews are being broadcast, recorded, or tweeted, people are going to see what you wrote if you clean it up, and they're going to say, that's not what he said. And so it's partly by – or not by choice, because the fact that there's so many recordings out there. Recordings have changed the game in so many ways. But this is a small way that, okay, people are going to see that you quoted someone and that's not exactly how he said it. And now that throws everything else that you report into question, right? If I can't trust you to quote this person accurately, when I see what he or she said and I see that you changed that, how can I – trust you on anything else.
Yeah. The old joke at SI would be there'd be an editor asking what color the ship is, and that's how they'd ruin the quote. The yellow ship be sinking. The Undefeated, I really like. I just want to mention,
that was something else I learned was that story really popped. That was the first thing I did. That one, and then I wrote something about the hurdlers with the flag, that picture, how that moment.
Right.
Especially in the context of Kaepernick. And the responses I got from that, so it really showed what they're doing in Undefeated, the platform and the interest that's there, and the opportunity to go down different avenues that maybe we wouldn't have even on ESPN.com.
Yeah, I want to ask you about that. I like it. I think there's a lot of interesting voices there and interesting writers. My question for you, and clearly you wanted to be a part of that, and now I think Kevin Merida, am I pronouncing his name right?
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, obviously the guy had incredible success at the Washington Post, and the thing that's very clear is people love working for him, which is, to me, the whole key to management.
And it was such a great indication. I mean, obviously they're going to make a commitment to get a Kevin Merida to come over from the Washington Post to a website that hadn't even gotten off the ground yet.
Right. My question for you is, do you, as someone who's worked at ESPN for a long time, we saw what happened in Grantland. How confident are you that the Undefeated is here for, like, do you believe they're committed to this multiple years?
Absolutely.
Okay, why?
And the fact that Kevin Merida is there, you know, think about what they had to tell him to get him to leave the Washington Post. And that they saw this through, and you know, the funding that we did a panel discussion I hosted with Oscar Robertson at the African American History Museum in Washington, and the you know, the thing they did with President Obama, the town hall, they just had the thing with Serena
and Common.
So I mean, you're seeing
they're putting money behind.
I mean, they sent Mark Spears to China to do a Stephon Marbury piece.
I saw that. Yeah,
you know, so they're making that type of commitment. You know, they realize that there's, you know, and the whole thing is they looked at the numbers and they said, okay, we're not getting African American audiences to come to ESPN.com.
Right.
What can we do? How can we serve them? You know, how can we create this opportunity to draw them in? And because they understand that there's money, you know, look, everything they're doing is for financial reasons.
Correct.
And there's this audience that they haven't been able to tap into that I think they believe they can have a consistent engagement with if they make the Undefeated a place for that readership, for that audience to go.
There's a lot of things you criticize ESPN for, and anybody who reads this.
A lot of things you criticize ESPN.
For sure.
No, but I mean, there's valid. There's lots of valid criticism.
But I would say this. This is actually, Jay, I'm about to praise your company. John Skipper and management there, they understand the demographics of the country are changing, and they've really made they've put their money behind hiring to bring in voices of color, women in prominent positions. They've ratcheted up their Hispanic programming because they understand that in order for this company to succeed and thrive 20, 30 years from now, they need that audience. They've put money behind this stuff, and I think it will pay off. It may not pay – you know what? Like, it may not pay off today, and some of these shows may not be rated great in 2016, but 2025, it's going to pay off. And I give Skipper and ESPN management a lot of credit because they are ahead of the curve and way ahead of the curve, in my opinion, against their competitors.
And when you look at the studies, you know, like Richard Lapchick's studying of diversity in media.
Yeah, without ESPN, it's a disaster.
Abysmal.
Yeah. I mean, it's a joke. And listen, SI should take all the hits that they should take for that. I would always say if you want to criticize SI for not. SI.com is much, much better now. It's almost the numbers with people of color in the newsroom. I don't know if it's 50-50, but it's close. But the magazine really needs to change, and we need more diverse voices. For sure. And you're right, that Lapchick study basically says without ESPN, it's a disaster.
Well, and the interesting thing is, okay, well, where do newspapers going to fit into this? And I'm not as concerned now because, you know, that's not the future where the industry is going.
Right.
So, you know, are young Latino kids or African-American kids going to have opportunities in the podcast sphere in you know?
A lot of them are going to have to sort of create it on their own, but they're going to. They're going to create big networks
on their own. And that's part of the lessons and you know, if I can bring this back to Northwestern, when I look at, okay.
It's always about Northwestern with you, Jay.
Well, that's why I'm here. But, you know, people ask, okay, how can you adapt your curriculum to the modern age? And, you know, the point I've been making is that, you know, nothing I learned at Northwestern necessarily specifically prepared me for a world of podcasts, of social media. You know, nothing that I do now at ESPN.com or Silent Report, like, Around the Horn, these things didn't exist when I was at Northwestern.
Right.
I was literally on typewriters my freshman year. We were the last class of 92. We were the last class to use typewriters. That was the world we were in. But the fundamentals of what we learned about reporting and accuracy and fairness and all those things, how to avoid libel lawsuits, all those things apply. You know, and those have enabled me and, you know, the likes of Wilbon and, you know, the dinosaurs, so to speak, to thrive in this current era because of what we learn, and that doesn't go away. That hasn't changed, even though the mediums have changed, even though the, you know, the delivery methods have changed. You know, none of the fundamentals have gone away, and you can always learn. That's why I always tell people, just even making the transition to TV, you can learn the TV. We were all bad at TV when we started. Go back and look at early Peter Gammons or Chris Mortensen when they're making that transition.
Right.
But you can learn, you know, if people are invested in you and they're willing to make that commitment, you know, they'll help you adapt to that medium. And you can learn the TV, but, you know, the reason they were sought after was their reporting chops.
We're an hour in. I haven't mentioned Rovell and Northwestern. You proud of me?
Good. Or Around the Horn. Can we talk about
Around the Horn? Yeah, we're going Around the Horn now. I got four topics left, and I'll get you out of here. All right, so let's talk about Around the Horn. I think Around the Horn is a much smarter show now, in my opinion, than it used to be. And I give Aaron Solomon, your guy, Ride Home, and the people on that staff credit. They've expanded the base to include new voices, many more women now on that show. It got younger. It got smarter. I would never say otherwise. Now, the show did enable Jay Mariotti for a decade, which really was not a good thing, I think, for society. I'm also happy Frank Isola can pay for his college kids' education.
At Northwestern.
With that show, at Northwestern. Probably getting like $1,500 a show, whatever that is. That's pretty nice money. That would be fun. All right, listen. Here's my one criticism still with Around the Horn. Not one criticism. For me, it reduces writers, smart writers, to sound bites. And even though the people on that show like yourself are smart, I do think it does send a message into the marketplace that everybody's a barking seal in sports and that it's all about sort of quick soundbite economy. And it does send a message that that's what sports journalism is about. Now, I'm on the outside. You're on the inside. I would always say this, and Aaron Solomon and I have gone back and forth, certainly on Twitter. there are very smart people who produce the show. I would never say otherwise. Even bad shows, and I'm not saying Around the Horn is, there's smart people behind it, and this show has gotten smarter. So tell me where I'm off, and tell me if I'm being too like old school and hardcore about this idea that blasting opinions sort of for points is like tell me why I'm wrong in terms of like that's not sort of aiming for lowest common denominator theater.
I will say, isn't that our world now? Aren't we in a 140 character world where you have to be smart? But the restriction of 140 characters is also a challenge. Can you get your point across in 140 characters? Can I go on Around the Horn and get my point across in 30 seconds? And brevity is the direction that we're going in, right? For better or for worse.
Agree.
That's the media world that we live in now.
In some cases. It's a longer
discussion. I mean, you also have the opportunity. Yeah, there's long form, too.
Right.
And ESPN has, E60. Like, we certainly have formats, 30 for 30, where you can go for a deep dive. If anything, we were ahead of the time, if you think about it. Because we came out before social media. We came out before these quick takes that they came out in, and it was jarring probably to see it, and we might not have been very good. We might not have known what we were doing, and as I said earlier, people who weren't TV people were trying to be TV people. So, don't judge us on 2002, judge us on now, and you just have to understand that there's limitations. I mean, can you have a nuanced discussion on Around the Horn? No. PTI allows you to do that. The format allows you to do that. One thing I will say about Around the Horn is it allows you to get your point across exactly how you want. It might not be as long as you want, but in PTI, you might have a point you want to make, but the conversation goes in a different direction. When you do PTI, they tell you, follow the conversation. Don't just be adamant about, I've got these things I've researched, I got to get. And if the conversation goes in a different direction, you have to allow for it to do that. So believe it or not, it's actually easier to get your point across on Around the Horn, even though it might be shorter, but you've got 30 seconds, but those 30 seconds, you can do whatever you want. And that's a pretty powerful thing. 30 seconds on ESPN to have your say, or even for the final thoughts. If you win and you just get that, that's your time. I would think about that platform.
Right.
On the second most watched sports show daily, every day, you could talk about all, and we can get into FS1 and what they're doing, too.
Second most watched studio show consistently, sports studio show.
I've been really adamant about tuning our horn lately because I think that gets lost. We've been on for 14 years, I think 3,500 shows, and it's PTI and then us in terms of what people are watching in these studio spaces.
That I will say this, you make a good point in the Twitter thing, and listen, I'm somebody who's certainly very active on Twitter, so I will try to think of it like that in terms of, okay, like,
we were Twitter before Twitter.
Right.
On
the one hand, you can't sort of say that everybody's barking like a seal if you're tweeting out 140 thoughts. To look at it that way, I think is, I mean, I still have some issues with that show, but I think how you phrase it there is smart. And I will try to look at it from that perspective because
you don't want to interrupt, talk about the fact that we don't interrupt. I know I'm interrupting you right now, but on that show, we're not actually shouting over each other.
True.
And we have the reputation for doing that, but it's actually very organized and it's very calibrated so that it's not people shouting over each other. It's this person's turn and this person's turn and this person's turn. And Tony Reale does a masterful job, I think, of navigating and is getting us and spinning. And one more thing, if I may say so.
Go ahead. It's your podcast.
I like the versatility of our show, but both the variety, as you alluded to, we can go young, old,
right,
male, female, different, different ethnicities, gay, straight, everything you ask for. But we can also go serious or silly, and we can, if there's a serious subject.
Unless it's an ESPN subject and you can't touch it.
No. And I don't mind that. There's restrictions on everything. And people talk about, you're muzzled. There's stuff I can't say. I can't curse on air like we've been doing in our podcast here.
It's a shame.
There's things I don't say on social media because I want to keep my job. And also, having two jobs now, there's things as a representative of a university that I don't want to be talking about on social media. So I'm muzzled in a lot of ways, yes. But those are the trade-offs you make if you work in major corporations or a major university. But I guess just to get back to my original point is that I like the fact that we can be serious, we can be silly, we can have a goofy, fake Christmas CD, Or, you know, we can have serious discussions, non-scoring discussions, or, you know, we put the points away and let's have a serious talk here. And I think our show is able to do that.
Yeah, that's a good sell for Around the Horn. I appreciate that. And hopefully, if, you know, Barstool and Sports Illustrated combine forces, we're going to try to take you on in the same thing. But that's good. All right, one... And
if I can also say, like, the fact, would Jamel and Michael Smith be where they were? Would Josh Elliott be where he is without our show?
No, that show, I will say this, the... Eric Rydholm has launched so many people into, you know, sort of stratospheric positions in sports media. You know, look at what he's doing now with Vice as well. He's obviously, you know, I've always said this to young people, man, if you can get into that guy's orbit,
yeah,
you are in a good position, because he has really given people of different ethnicities, of different sexualities, of different ages, he's really given them opportunity.
So the opportunities for those people that you mentioned, but also the format ideas. And
right.
And he did make it faster. And he was ahead of the game, though. He almost anticipated, you know, the brevity that right. dominates media now.
And look at political shows have now copied him.
Right. And, you know, the rundown. So the two things, you know, the on-screen rundown.
Which is the edge.
And then, but then that clock, too. And PTI is funny. I teach my students this. I show them. I go back and show them the old sports writers on TV in Chicago.
Right.
And early sports reporters on ESPN on Sundays. You know, like... 8-10 minute segments on one topic, which is just unfathomable now.
It's not gonna happen.
You know, but you know, PTI got it to like 90 seconds on a topic, and you know, we might be even faster, you know, in buy or sell on our show. But that's the way people consume media now, right? And he was doing that in the early 2000s. So he was way ahead of the game there. And it's funny, a lot of other people are getting a lot of attention right now, but let's not sleep on what Eric Rydholm did. He got to the point where everyone else was trying to get.
Yeah, early. Now he's just kicking back in Brooklyn now, enjoying his multi-million dollar life. All right, here's the last two topics. We're gonna get, you had a couple people who had questions for you, but I want to ask you something about Wilbon, because I know how close you are with him. It's fair to say he's been a mentor to you?
Mentor, best friend,
everything. Okay. So this is, I want to ask you, this is sort of some criticism of Wilbon, and the interesting thing about him is that, you know, I read the criticism and I agree with some of it, but then I also hear from people who have interacted with him, younger people, and how much he's done for them. Obviously, you're a perfect example of this. So he's an interesting guy in that sense. So this is something Deadspin wrote about Wilbon not too long ago, and obviously, you know, it's not going to be praiseworthy of Wilbon. And they're basically saying they're taking him to task for criticizing a Washington Post columnist, blogger, Dan Steinberg. And they're going after him, saying, this is what you're paying $8 million for ESPN. You're paying all that money to a petty bag of shit who enjoys using his former position and his celebrity connections as a means of extolling himself, blah, blah, and it sort of goes on to that. A lot of the criticism from Mike is that he's become a celebrity journalist. You know, Deadspin used to, like, goes after him, calls him a star fucker basically all the time. And I want, as someone who knows him, as someone who clearly
admires him,
loves him, how do you see that kind of criticism of Michael Wilbon, that whatever you – for some who believe that at one time he represented whatever the sports columnist is supposed to be and has now become the celebritization of the field?
Well, first of all, everyone should be happy, right? If he's making that money, then he's paving the path for other people to make the money. Does Bill Simmons make the money that he makes without Michael Wilbon and Kornheiser coming along?
No chance.
You know, so – Skip Bayless, all the people making money, they should send
some of
it his way.
That's not a positive thing, but okay.
But
I understand what you're saying, right?
Regardless of you know, what you feel about the individual, you should be happy for our profession.
Absolutely.
That there's that opportunity. Like, our students coming up should be excited that, hey, I'm not saying it's guaranteed, but it's out there.
But it exists.
So he played a large role in that. Why shouldn't he reap the benefits? And then B, it's not like he still isn't going to games. You know, he's a little more focused on NBA now, but you'll still see him a lot. He'll still go to a Bulls game, or he'll be out in Phoenix and he'll drop in on a Suns game, and he's still in there talking to people. And you know, I think as long as he's using that access that he has, that the affinity and affiliation that people have for him, as long as he can translate that into providing information for the viewers and the listeners and the audience, then who loses? You know, if you can benefit from the access that he has, and that's really what we're there to do, right? We're supposed to represent the people. So I don't think he's just there talking to people, hanging out with people just for the sake of doing it. You know, it usually comes back around to, okay, here's this access. I would say Tony Kornheiser, the year he did Monday Night Football, you know, he might not have been the best thing for Monday Night Football, but it was great for PTI. Like, he was so much better on PTI because he was out there talking to coaches, and he could say, here's what I learned in our meeting with Coach so-and-so.
Right.
And Wilmot's still out and around, and now he's going to be in L.A. more. Now he's back in the studio with Magic. I'm ecstatic that duo has been reunited on our airwaves. So he's still going to be out and around. He has used his gains. I've benefited from it. You know, like I've swam in his pool in Scottsdale, thinking, hey, if you can't be rich, have rich friends. You know, like he's shared so much. He's always back at NABJ, helping out the students, mentoring people. You know, so like, you know, literally whether it's paying for meals or providing opportunities for his friends, like it doesn't just end at him, is what I'm saying. You know, and it continues. He passes it along in many ways. He passes his experience. He came in and met with my students, the sports specialization grad students, you know, and he was very active. Jay, I'm going to be in Chicago. Let's do something. And first time we couldn't do it. The second time we made it happen, and just came on a Saturday, hour and a half with our students. Ask whatever you want, you know, and here's your chance to talk to one of the leaders in the field. You know, he's somewhere where they all want to be, right? And here was him giving his time to help them get to where he is. He's more than willing to help Northwestern specifically, but really so many young people that come up and want to get to where he is, he's willing to help them get there.
This podcast has convinced me I need more wealthier friends, for sure.
If you can't be rich, have rich friends.
I like that. The one last one on this, and it sort of plays off this Wilmot thing. One of the things I think that teaching young people does help you with is it does ground you. It reminds you of when you were 22, 23. So my sense is that, you know, even if you were going – and I'm not saying – you know, sort of talked about Wilbon, right? I'm not saying he is this, but even if you were going to sort of go the route of Diva and sort of thinking that your shit is the best, does it not help you to be around the 22 or 23-year-old who's at the beginning of their career and you sort of recognize that there's a larger sort of role for you and it's important to sort of be – that's what I think even working at Columbia does for me, is it sort of grounds me to the
Absolutely.
Reality, you know what I mean?
Absolutely. And it reminds you of when you're coming up. And,
exactly.
And keeps you from being jaded. I've been to so many games.
Same here.
So many arenas and – okay, yeah, all right, yeah, I'm going to go talk to Kobe today. And, you know, then I'll tell you what also grounds you is some days, you know, you might be talking to Kobe, and then he turns around and he goes in and meets with the Make-A-Wish kids. And, like, what I do on a daily basis is literally these kids' dying wish.
Right.
You know, they would just to spend 10 minutes with Kobe just made their day. And
yeah, Cam Newton just did one. It was pretty impressive.
Yeah. And you know, like, and as athletes, oh, we got to go talk to these players, you know, and like some kids, that was a dream. And once upon a time, that was my dream. You know, I wanted to be around the Lakers. The whole reason I got into this business was I wanted to have an excuse or a reason to be at the Forum watching the Lakers. You know, of course, they're not at the Forum anymore, but you know, you get the idea. And it does remind you of that. And it's funny. So I would bring my class to, usually worked out to be a Clipper game just because of the schedule. I'd bring them to a Clipper game, you know, and they'd go around and same thing. They're just looking around. And a guy named AB who works in the Chick Hearn press room and you know, he just kind of oversees the room and you go through. And he would always ask me, when you bring the students? Because he says, I love seeing the looks on their faces.
That's
when they
cool.
walk in and they're wide-eyed. And, you know, I take them, you know, they don't get to go to the locker room areas or they don't get to be around the court. And you see them there, and they're so excited. And that's always the highlight of the quarter or the semester for them, was getting to go to a game at Staples Center and having a press pass. And what makes me really excited is when I see my former students now, you know, they'll be alongside me in the press conferences or in the hallways at Staples Center, and they're getting to live their dreams. And I got to do it. I did it for a long time. I'm not done doing it. But what really motivates me now is to get people – you know, to give young people a chance to do it and to do everything. I got everything I wanted out of this. I'm not sure how many people can say that, but I'm very fortunate. I got everything I wanted and more.
Who's an underrated NBA interview or multiple guys who just, you know, Kobe had a reputation of being an interesting interview and, you know, obviously LeBron, et cetera, but who in the league, like Tony Allen always strikes me as a guy who, like, maybe the nationally you don't know how great he is, but if you talk to him, he's awesome. So are there Who are a couple of these guys?
Like a Zach Randolph, if you want to stick with the Grizzlies. A Sean Livingston. You know, Vince Carter has gotten better. Like, the people who have managed to stick around the league, you know, and aren't there just for their talent. You know, they figured out a way, and they figured out how the league works.
Right. The Juwan Howard way?
Yeah. And it's funny. Juwan was a guy I was around from the Fab 5 days in Michigan. I covered him, and then I was in Washington with him. I love sitting with those guys. And it's funny because, like, Jeff Van Gundy, when we're working, was like, why do you talk to those guys? Like, you know, you get so much more talking to an Andre Iguodala or a Sean Livingston than you do from a Steph Curry.
Right.
And I like Steph a lot, and he's very accessible. He's very easy to work with.
For a star, he's amazing.
You know, right. he's great to work with, and he gives his time. And, like, Steph is great. But, like, I can't learn as much from him.
Right.
He doesn't give you as much. You know, and probably because he hasn't, and he's got more to protect now too, as his brand is and his name has been elevated. But you know, give me the guys not necessarily at the end of the bench, but in the middle of the bench. You know, David West is fascinating and can take you in so many different directions. You know, perspective on race in our society. Give me a veteran guy that I can just go sit his locker and talk to for a while. And again, that's something that a Wilbon will do too. You know, he knows how to seek out those guys, and you can get so much from them.
We could have done 90 minutes on the NBA alone, but I'm going to let you get out of here.
I love the NBA.
All right, Jay, first of all, you're too calm, Jay. I feel like this is very relaxing talking to you. You're like human chai tea or something.
Well, one of the reasons I came in is I wanted to be more engaged in this podcast. That's why I'm in the studio.
I know,
so
I feel
I'm
like
hoping I'm not lulling you to
you
sleep.
You have. I feel like I feel like you beat me down on Around the Horn. The Wilbon thing, you sort of, you know, you calmly took the criticism there. And so you're literally like you're like human chamomile, basically, is what you're I'm trying to think of a tea that's common.
I'm gonna change my Twitter bio to human chamomile.
That's my legacy of this podcast.
But it's actually, it gets to a point, like, there's more than different ways to do it, and there's different ways to do a show like Around the Horn.
Certainly, right.
And so my colleague Steve Shenbaum, I don't know if you've dealt with him, he does Game On Media. So
I know the name, though.
He does, you know, he went to Northwestern.
There's another
about Northwestern. I know. The Purple Mafia. But we went to school together, and he's a guy who turned his love, so he was a theater major.
Oh, wow.
And he had a pretty good career. He was in American Pie 2, had some national TV commercials, had a role in Space Jam, actually.
Nice.
When Michael was playing baseball in Space Jam. But so he did well for himself, but he was never a star. And then he reached that age where, like, you're kind of this in-between age in Hollywood. And so what he did was he turned his love of sports combined with his knowledge of theater, and he created this program where he works with teams and companies and using kind of improv stuff and just to elicit teamwork and
oh,
get people
cool.
to come out of their shells. But he also does media training. So I talked to him when I was first starting Around the Horn, and he said, you can stand out by going low. It's kind of the opposite of the Michelle Obama theory, but, like, actually when others are high energy,
right,
if you go low, you stand out. So if three people are yelling, and if I come in at a lower level, I stick out.
Right. And think of the people who were there at the time, Paige, Marianne, they were all high guys for the most
and
part.
And that show makes me, quote unquote, high too, energy. Like, a lot of people that meet me and, you know, you sitting here talking to me, you're like, you're a very low-key, calm guy.
Right.
And then they see me on Around the Horn, they're like, oh my God, you're so different. Well, first of all, you have to be.
Of course.
A, to keep up on that show, but just TV in general. Like, the person that I am is not good for TV. And I tell my students this. You have to be more energetic than you are. You have to, and Steve told me this, you're playing a character based on yourself.
Right.
So I can't be me. You can't be natural. Like, Stephen A is actually that way. Like, he can be, I've been in the car with him, and he can hit that Stephen A volume. That's who he is. But it's also work, too. Like, think about it. It might annoy you that he's at that level, but you have to respect the ability to do so on TV and then to go on radio and to hit that level.
Right.
I remember seeing him during the finals. He's like, man, I'm like, it's wearing him out. It's hard to be on that level.
But every producer will tell you that you have to
bring
it. It's
great TV. And it's funny. Yeah. And, like, when I go on radio with him, he brings that out of me. So he's good on TV. And I have to try to approximate that some way. I can't. I can't be him.
Right.
I can be a more energetic version of me. But also, by being my kind of low-key self, I give you a different look on Around the Horn.
Especially if you're with other people who are high.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, let's go through the litany of the J.A. Adande resume very quickly. You are currently at the Northwestern Medill School, the director of the sports journalism program there, living in Chicago part-time as well as somewhere near an ocean in California. You are still working as a NBA sideline reporter, correct?
Correct.
All right. You're doing columns for The Undefeated. Are you doing NBA columns still for ESPN occasionally?
Yeah, I just had a lot of our Sneaker Week content.
Oh, Sneaker Week. You're right. I'm sorry. I apologize.
But I'm also I'm in the midst of working on some other projects right now. Some on coaches. So we're still doing that. It'll be interesting to see what we do in the playoffs this year. A, the nature of our coverage is changing. B, my availability is going to be different. But I'm still under contract.
When's your next game? When are we going to see you on TV?
January 11th. I'm doing Cleveland at Portland. Looking forward to that.
All right. Ty Lue's good to talk to at halftime.
Ty Lue. Yeah.
I feel like he gives you something as a coach.
Terry Stotts. You know what's funny?
You
know what's funny is sometimes it's the unexpected coaches. I tell people one of the best lines I had was from Rick Adelman. Like, you wouldn't expect that, right? But I talked to him. I said, Coach, Rick Rubio was sick. He was a game-time decision. He had a stomach ailment. How do you think he's done so far? And he said, well, at least he has an excuse. I don't know about the rest of the guys. I was like, okay, Rick. But Terry Stotts actually it was the weekend when Prince died last year, and I was doing a playoff game up there.
Right.
And I had a purple tie on and maybe something else purple. And so we're finishing up our pregame meeting. He said, is that for Prince? And I said, yeah. And he says, check this out. And so he opens up his little closet, and he said, yeah, like a purple tie, purple shirt, like a little purple, what's it called, pocket square. And then he goes, and check this out. And he pulls out these purple socks. And I was like, oh! And he goes, oh! And so I actually asked him about during. I said, if they're up going into the fourth quarter, I'm gonna ask him about the Prince stuff.
But they were
so,
up,
yeah. So they're up, and so you know, we have fun with it. So you can have fun with these guys too. And sometimes it's the unexpected people like
that.
Like
it's a great. I mean, best league though for coaches. I mean, they're just honest. They're open. Players are great.
And what they're all social amazing. Issues. And,
far and away the best league.
And absurdity. It's all there.
It's great. It's a great league. If I could do it again and was going to sort of focus on a singular sport,
we'll do an NBA podcast.
We'll do an NBA podcast. All right. Does anyone else have any questions in the studio for JA? No, there's only four people in the studio right now, so no one has questions. All right,
any more reader questions?
One more reader question that I didn't get to. I mean, I'm trying to get you out of here, Jay, but if you really want to answer more questions, you covered the 90s Bulls. This is from a guy named Tolly Taylor. What was a story you couldn't tell then but can reveal now? Did you cover the 90s Bulls? I mean, sort of.
Well, it's funny. So I was around them in the 93 playoff run. That was my first year working. The 93 playoff run, I was on the beat in 94 without Jordan.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting year.
I'll tell the story. The time I interviewed Scottie Pippen in the bathroom.
I'm always interested in Scottie Pippen bathroom stories.
So it was the night of the infamous 1.8 seconds. Right?
Oh, right. Yeah, right. I'm not going in.
So he, you know, the Bulls come out on the court. They're trailing the Knicks by one, I guess, playoff series game three, the conference semifinals in 1994, just to set the stage. The Bulls call a play. Phil Jackson draws up a play to have Scottie Pippen inbound in the ball. He wasn't trying to have it, so he stayed on the bench, and they wound up sitting out the last 1.8 seconds. Tony Kukoc makes a game-winning shot. Phil kind of sold out Scottie. The post-game, it said Scottie asked out the game. And a whole big hubbub, right? Scottie leaves, doesn't talk to the media. So there was a spot called Bijan. It's still there. It's in a new location. It's been redone, but It was good because they served, the kitchen was open until like 3 or 4 in the morning. So that's where we go after the game. And some of the Bulls would be there. Some media people would be there. And so I see Scottie, and he motions me to, you know, follow me. So I follow him. He goes in the bathroom, and he's at the urinal doing his thing. And he says, so what'd you write? So I told him, and then he kind of unloaded some thoughts and, you know, some complaints. So, you know, I couldn't quote him. It's kind of my policy. I don't quote people at urinals.
Right. Did he make it clear? It's interesting. Did he say off the record, or did you sort of presume that just two guys talking, this is not on the record?
My rule of thumb has always been if I have a drink in my hand and not a recorder, it's off the record.
Okay.
I've never explicitly said that. I've told a couple guys this, but they just kind of said. But what it did was inform my story for the next day.
Right.
And so at least I knew what his mindset was and what his complaints were and his airing of grievances, so to speak.
Interesting.
So if you go back and look at my story from the next day, a lot of that was informed by what I learned in the bathroom at Bijan.
No kidding. That's interesting. And that's actually an interesting philosophy, like policy sort of, that like, you know, if you sort of set the atmosphere that you are not at your job, meaning that you have a drink in your hand, that's sort of the message you're giving out to potential subjects that we're just talking here. This is not on the record.
But I don't know.
What's interesting is I don't know if everybody would follow the same policy you have. At the same time, if somebody wrote what Pippin did and Pippin didn't like, he'd never talk to you again.
Right.
So that's sort of where you could
And it's interesting because now there's not that journalist. Let's say, God, who knows? Somebody could have been in that bathroom and overheard.
Right, yeah.
And in today's age—
Lubica was in the bathroom. He wrote it for the Daily
News. But that's the thing. Like, you don't worry about a journalist. You worry about a non-journalist, you know, taking to social media.
Right. Imagine you know? That becomes
I
like a
I think we were
like
the only two people
periscope.
In there. Yeah, but you know, that very easily could.
In 2016, right.
You hear the flush in the background, right? But, you know, but I think most people understand that.
I agree.
You see very rarely. Well, also that's another thing the recordings do too. Is you know you know what you never hear. I was misquoted. That never comes out anymore. And you even rarely hear I was taken out of context because you know the larger space and recording kind of allows the context to be alluded to too. So those are two things that have gone. You know the new one for a while was my Twitter account was hacked. But you know people don't even you know they know we're not buying that anymore either. But yeah that. Yeah, on and off the record is an interesting construct. The game has changed the fact that there's so many people out there that have access to media now through their Twitter accounts or whatever that don't follow the rules or don't feel the need to follow the rules.
Yeah, again, that's another podcast that we could sort of just do on our own.
MBA on and off the record.
Yeah. Well, there's actually, I mean, we really could do a journal. It'd be really interesting with you just to do a journalism-only podcast where we just sort of discuss different things
issues.
That sports journalists have to go through in 2016.
Well, but I
like cleaning up quotes is something that not a lot of you were the first person I think to write about that nationally in a long time. It's a really important discussion I think for younger journalists to sort of think about.
I'm glad that you provided me the forum first and foremost.
Thanks for coming in.
I wanted to let you know just raise awareness of what we're doing at Medill, and
I was happy to help one of the top five journalism schools behind Columbia. You know that
medill.northwestern.edu. If you want a journalism school with a lake, if you want to come to the lovely Lakeside campus in Evanston,
right.
And obviously, you know, it's funny. Somebody came up to me last night. I was like, hey, you know, I'm a Syracuse Morehouse guy. I know you're Northwestern, but I said, well, you're doing something right if you're at Syracuse. You're just not doing everything right. But you're doing something. But obviously, you know, you can get a great education and great journalism experience and have access to a lot of people, you know, Syracuse or Columbia or Missouri.
The Northwestern alumni.
There's a lot of places.
You know, it just reaches from California to Maine, especially in sports.
I mean, I think we're unique. I'm personally invested in it, you know, and I really want to encourage people to join the family and to come experience it and, you know, to hopefully get the same things out of it that I was able to. I've been very fortunate. And the reason I went back there is I feel I owe so much of it to Northwestern, and it set me up for these last 25 years.
All right, let your dean know, Jay. You just got 94 minutes of free publicity for Northwestern.
I'm about to go see him at the tailgate, so I'll let him know.
All right, J.A. Adonde has been the guest. I mean, I don't need to give his resume again because I think I've given it at this point 18 times. But you know him from ESPN. Obviously, he's bleeding Northwestern purple. And we appreciate him coming in studio. Second week in a row, an in-studio guest. Jay, listen, continued success. I really admire the decision that you made as somebody who teaches as well. And thank you so much for joining us on the Sports Illustrated
Media
Podcast.
And keep fighting the fight. Keep holding people accountable in the sports media world.
And until I eventually quit. Thank you, J.A. All right, back in the studio, my thanks to J.A. Adonde, who put in a lot of time here. We could have gone much longer because we didn't even really hit a lot of the sports journalism issues that he's dealing with his students. And there's a lot there. But he is really a calming guy in person, so you can understand why people gravitate towards the guy. He's a relaxing figure, which I appreciate. And I appreciate him coming in studio, too. Always better when the guests are here, certainly for sound quality that you guys have set. So thank you very much to J.A. Adonde, who has left the studio now, off to see his beloved Northwestern play. I think it's the Pinstripe Bowl. My thanks to Lou Pellegrino, my producer for this podcast. Thank you to Digital Media. Thanks to the guys at SI who support this podcast, from John Wertheim, Chris Stone, Ryan Hunt, and Ben Eagle. Thank you very much for listening to the last couple of podcasts. The numbers are through the roof. Barstool CEO Erica Nardini, one of the most listened to podcasts we've had in months. Barstool people coming out for that, for sure. Jim Miller, the author, again, numbers along with Nardini through the roof. People just seem to like Jim Miller. And Lauren Duca, the 25-year-old writer who's getting a lot of acclaim and recently did Tucker Carlson the other day, held their own pretty nicely, and we wish good things for her. So those are the last three podcasts in addition to J.A. We'll be back in 2017 with some interesting guests. Mike Tirico is going to be one of the podcasts coming up sometime in 2017. We'll obviously have some other interesting people. Can't thank you enough for listening. This is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.